The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly. It really is so close to coming home now, or at least being at home. Did we learn anything from England's 1-0 win over Romania? Jack Grealish is good. Luke Shaw is good. Sam Johnson is about as good as Jordan Pickford. Marcus Rashford is better at penalties than Jordan Henderson. Ben White gets the last call up. Is that the right decision? Might he even start against Croatia? Off the pitch, boos again as the players take the knee. What can be done about it? And how should we cover it? Elsewhere, Scotland beat Luxembourg and Wales draw with Albania. There's lots of fun in Denver as the US beat Mexico in the CONCACAF Nations League. Joy for Jeff Stelling as Hartlepool progress in the National League playoffs. And plenty of your emails. All that, plus your questions. And that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. Dave says, is Barry Glendening being rested a la Foden and Mount? If so, can Max give everyone a reassuring statement about his fitness and let us know that this potential lack of match sharpness won't affect his ability to argue with Wilson on the big stage? No Barry for a whole week. What a relief. Jonathan Wilson, welcome to the pod.
Thank you very much. How are you doing?
I'm good, thank you. Jonathan Faduba, how are you doing? I think you might be muted, which is a slight issue for a pod.
Sorry about that. Yeah, I'm good. Thank you, Max.
Excellent. Jacob Steinberg. Hello, mate.
Hi.
Are you well, Jacob?
I'm very good. Are you?
Excellent. Yeah, I'm excellent. I'm very well, yeah. Should we start on the pitch then with England-Romania? Jacob, what did you make of this game?
Hard to make sweeping judgments because there's still a load of players who you would expect quite a few of them to start against Croatia on Sunday, not involved against Romania. So, you know, all the Chelsea and Manchester City players, quite a few of those, I think, will come in. And it's been so disjointed. I think it's something that's been a problem for Southgate, the issues going into the Austria game without the Manchester United players and the Champions League final players, the injuries that have affected certain players, just the lack of time. You know, the season's just ended and the Euros is right upon us. And it's not been very easy for anybody, but particularly England with the European finals sort of disrupting some of the plans. So these games have been a little bit difficult to work out at times because it's really not anywhere near close to the team. I think we'll start against Croatia on Sunday. At the same time, you can pick out certain positives. I think that Jack Grealish in both games has made it very hard for Southgate to not pick him against Croatia. I'm still not sure whether he will, but I think it's hard for him now after what he did yesterday and against Austria. Really good to see how Ben White played on Sunday at centre back. You know, for somebody who was making his first start, even if it was against weak opposition, he really didn't look out of place. And the way that he has played in these games and the fact that he's come in for Trent Alexander-Arnold makes you kind of think: should he have been in here a little bit sooner? Is he potentially already a better option than Connor Cody and Tyrone Mings? I quite liked the way that Luke Shaw was going up and down. The one that I mentioned there, the negative, I think, is just the sort of the worries that I think every England fan is going to have around the defence. And I think that with Harry Maguire out, it's caused a bit of confusion on Southgate's end. I'm not sure if he knows exactly what he wants to do back there. And the way that Mings played against Austria with the off the ball thing, and then straight away yesterday he looked very suspect, caught out of position. It's causing a bit of issue, I think, to the balance of the side, whether he's going to go four, whether he's going to go three. The fact that White's come in, I don't think it would have happened, obviously, if Maguire was fit, and it may well have been Ward-Prowse, given the issues around Henderson. So it's just those little bits are causing, I think, a bit of a little bit of confusion, slightly sort of muddled thinking at times on England's part.
I think you're right that part of Ben White's selection has been because Cody and Mings haven't looked that comfortable. It's tricky, Wilson, isn't it, to judge everything in these two games that have been quite random. But I wonder if that's the case. So Ward-Prowse can feel really quite unlucky, even though a lot of people saying Ward-Prowse has to be there because he takes free kicks, even though nobody's putting him in their starting 11. So it doesn't matter how good you are at free kicks if you're not actually playing.
The Ward-Prowse position should not be anything to do with set pieces. That's a bit of a red herring. Until yesterday, I would have had Ward-Prowse as the 26th man. just because, you know, for exactly the reasons Jacob says, that if we're not quite sure about Henderson's fitness, who's the only other player in the squad who's sort of operates in that kind of role would be Bellingham, who has looked brilliant, but you know he is still a child. You know, so to be relying on a child for a tournament is probably not ideal. But given the issues with Maguire and also with Mings and Cody, then I think Ben White is the right decision. I think probably now I would start him. But it's always a problem with international football that, you know, England play maybe a dozen games a year. So each of those games, even when it's a radically changed lineup to what we expect to play against Croatia, we try and read far too much into those matches, which is natural because it's the only evidence you have. I don't know, if a youth team player who'd been on the fringe, I know that's not quite what Grealish is, but if a fringe player suddenly played brilliantly for Manchester City in their final friendly before the start of the Premier League season, you wouldn't be saying, oh, drop Foden for him. I know it's not quite the same, it's not quite a fair comparison, but we do place huge stock in international friendlies, particularly those just before a tournament, that we don't place in club friendlies. As Jacob suggested, I think we come out of these two games more confused than we went into them. Well, certainly I do.
Jonathan, are you more confused than 2 weeks ago?
I'm not more confused than I was 2 weeks ago. I still think that most of the key decisions, of course Ben White's come through, but most of the key decisions that Gareth Southgate probably would have had to make are still kind of there. The big problem is kind of the England team's been hung up by the success of the Premier League to a certain extent, because obviously the Manchester City and Chelsea players haven't arrived yet, or they're not playing yet, so they're only just starting to train, and that's going to be a huge issue with the game starting this week, the tournament starting this week. So I think from Southgate's point of view, that's a real problem. Of course, the Manchester United players as well got getting to the Europa League finals. So, Marcus Rashford, Luke Shaw only managed to play brief appearances during the friendlies. So I think that's complicated it more than maybe him not knowing his team potentially. Do you throw Mason Mount, for example, and Phil Foden straight into it with no warm up time? You would suggest yes, because they're great players and they can adapt. But at the same time, you want a period of time to be able to bed them in and get your team ready, don't you? So it's unfortunate from that point of view. I don't think there was too much that would change. I still think that those players from Man City and Chelsea would probably come into the team. So I would probably expect Mount to definitely start. And I think Foden potentially will maybe start. It will either be him maybe or Raheem Sterling. So either one of them is, City or Chelsea kind of players. And so the problem doesn't really change there. Harry Kane's obviously going to start, so I don't think Calvert-Lewin, for example, did much to really get into the lineup. So most of the decisions, really, I think, are going to centre around how do the Man City and Chelsea players arrive? Do they do well in training this week? Can they kind of gel quickly and that kind of thing? I think Ben White did really well. He looked quite comfortable in that position. I would probably favour him ahead of Tyrone Mings personally. I think Tyrone Mings has looked okay, but I still think I'm not quite sure he's at the level, I think at top international level. So that's one position that I'd be fairly comfortable throwing White into it, to be honest. Shaw versus Chilwell is obviously another decision, but all in all, you don't learn too much from international friendlies in general, do you? It's always a bit, they kind of plod along, but I suppose you've got to get through them just to get them out of the way.
Yeah, I mean, it makes you wonder if there is a point to having them. It's just trying to work out exactly what that point is. And Jacob Wilson, talks about how much importance we place on these, 60 minutes for a player. And I was so guilty of that with Jadon Sancho yesterday, because he didn't have a brilliant 60 minutes. He didn't sort of get past his fullback. I can't remember him doing it once. And so instantly when I picked my, it gave me an excuse to drop him from my starting 11 against Croatia.
Yeah, I mean, I think with Sancho, I think anybody who watches a lot of German football would probably argue that people in England probably really underrate Jadon Sancho. And on the flip side, I think people who see him play once every, and we've barely seen him play as well because he's had the issues with COVID breach and then he was injured in March. So we've barely seen him play for England. And when he has, it's been okay. There have been some really encouraging flashes and then other times where it's not quite worked. I think that, it's just that issue for Southgate of whether he's going to trust the defence to play in a back four without Harry Maguire, which at this stage, the way that he's talking, could well be the entire group stage, or whether he's going to switch to a back three. If he does switch to the back three, then there's a load of players who are going to have to drop out. I don't see him playing Mason Mount in the two with Declan Rice. I mean, Chelsea more or less have never done it. Tuchel said it's not his position. And I would expect Mason Mount to pretty much start all the time. He basically has, it seems, no drop-off ever. So I think that he would probably be capable of playing seven games in a short amount of time. So you're only able to play one of Sterling, Grealish and Foden. And that's going to cause a lot of issues, I think. It's going to hurt the team if that happens. And by the same token, even if he's playing 4-3-3, you're wondering, how does he get all of Mount, Foden and Grealish into the side? I think it will probably be Grealish who misses out, because I think you can't not play Foden. And I think Southgate is so loyal to Raheem Sterling. And also, there's that issue that they're going to have around the lack of pace, potentially, of Sterling, Rashford or Sancho don't play alongside Harry Kane, because Kane isn't that, he's not slow, but he's not, you know, he's not devastatingly fast, is he? And he likes to drop deep and he likes to play those passes in behind. And if you don't have someone like Sterling or Sancho or Rashford playing, you're kind of losing that, because the other three are all going to want to play in front of defences. And, you know, can they get away with that? But I think it's going to be an unpopular choice if any of them aren't playing against Croatia, because I think Sterling winds a lot of people up now. But, you know, he's got that long history in the team, hasn't he?
I have found a way of getting Mount, Grealish and Foden in, Wilson. Am I doing the right thing?
Well, to be honest, it hadn't even occurred to me until yesterday that might be something that was worth doing. As you know, I would tend to put system first and then fit the players in. But Grealish has been so good in the two friendlies and so dynamic and has offered a sort of energy and a creativity that nobody else is offering. You sort of think, well, okay, how can we put him in and keep Foden in? So you switch to something approaching a 4-2-3-1. But if you do that, where does Mount play? You know, I agree with Jacob. I think to play him as one of the two might work, but I think it's a massive risk. And Tuchel obviously sees him every week, and yeah, he wouldn't do that. So I think that's probably something to be avoided. But then if you play Mount, then you don't have the runner to go beyond Kane. So I think it is a straight choice of Foden v Grealish. And I suppose the one thing you can say is that with five subs, you can sort of almost pre-program after an hour, you take off Foden, you bring on Grealish, assuming things are going well in group games, and then you can use Grealish to spare Foden a bit. But I think if it's a 4-3-3, then you have to have a creator and a runner alongside Kane.
But isn't Foden quite quick? Can't the fullbacks get in?
Yeah, it's not just about pace. It's about how they naturally play. Like if you don't want Foden to be trying to play like Sterling. Yeah, you want Foden to be playing like Foden because that's what he's good at. And that means drifting inside, finding spaces, creating angles. It doesn't mean just running beyond the centre forward, because you've got players who are better at running beyond the centre forward who can't do the things that he does not doing that. So the last thing you want to do is ask players to do things that aren't their natural game just to try and squeeze them in. I mean, I think the case study for this is Argentina over the last 20 years. That they've again and again and again gone to major tournaments, had this glut of forwards. How do we fit them all in? They create some terrible hodgepodge of a system that doesn't work. And they're asking Aguero to play wide on the left or whatever. And Argentina have failed to deliver on the talent they've got. I think you have to be a bit more ruthless and you have to say, no, this is the structure. And unfortunately, we're blessed. We have two or three really good players in this position, but only one of them can play. The problem is, the way we approach international football is to look at the people who aren't there rather than the people who are there and assume that, when things go wrong and England don't win the tournament, I mean, they could play very, very well and not win the tournament, and then still you get, if you pick Grealish from the start. But that's just, you can't do that.
You can go back to one of the England teams that Southgate played in under Hoddle, and he was very system oriented, with the back three. And there were players within that system that really should have taken them past Argentina in the last 16 that just weren't able to play. Someone like Steve McManaman, who was, pivotal in Euro 96, he just didn't have a place in that system because of the balance of the side. And that probably in 98 probably caused a lot of similar backlash towards the team. But the team itself was better. And there were a load of other, Letizier couldn't get in that team because he had Scholes and because he had Sheringham and all those kind of players. That it's just a decision that he's going to have to make in the end. And, you know, you can go back as well to 2006, Gerrard and Lampard. You know, he tried to fit those in. He just thought, well, these are the two best players. They're just going to overrun every single team because they're so good. And what happened? They were just rubbish because they didn't have the players behind them.
I have always wondered if Gerrard and Lampard could play together, but no one's discussed that. And I've only just stopped celebrating Sol Campbell's disallowed goal from 98.
I think even 2014 is an example of this, that I think Hodgson was encouragingly boring in the qualifiers. And then suddenly in those friendlies before the World Cup, he started trying to squeeze everybody in, trying to build the team around Sterling. And it went horribly wrong as a result. I think Hodgson allowed himself to be bullied by public pressure into being more attacking than he naturally wanted to be. And the results were England's worst ever World Cup for which they qualified. Well,
2016 too, he ends up with Rooney in midfield. So
yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah.
Jonathan, why in this discussion has no one mentioned Marcus Rashford yet? Youngest player to start a match as England captain since Michael Owen scored the penalty. I'm not sure how brilliantly he played yesterday, but it's interesting that we're talking about who's going to play either side of Kane and Rashford's name has yet to come up.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't personally play Rashford as much as I love him. I don't think he's had a great season. I think it's kind of gone a little bit under the radar how, I wouldn't say mediocre because he's still got 11 goals, I think 11 assists, but I don't think he's really had a good season. If you look at key games for Manchester United, you know, Europa League final, even yesterday, there was a moment in the sort of 11th minute, I think, where Rashford kind of went down the left and there was three remaining players that he tried to take on and he kind of faced them up, turned around, passed it to Grealish, and then Grealish kind of went through three of them and won a corner. And to me, that kind of summed up the two of them in terms of their form at the moment. For me, Grealish has to start. I think he's on form. I know that Southgate is kind of more of a team over, sort of a system over individual player. But I just think Grealish is in such good form. He's so exciting.
But okay, so where do you play him? Yeah, how do you fit him in? What's your team around Grealish?
I'd play him from the left. I mean, if it's going to be a 3-5-2, then I'd be tempted to play him off Kane, to be honest, if he's going to go for a 3-5-2. But I just think you have to fit him in. I don't see where Rashford would fit in over Grealish.
So okay, if you've got Kane and Grealish, what's your midfield?
Are we playing a 4 or a 3?
Depends on the system, yeah.
Because it seems weird that Southgate hasn't played a 3 at all in these two friendlies if we think he's going to play a 3 against Croatia. I understand the logic of playing a 3.
But I just think he hasn't had the players to do it because Kyle Walker and Reece James haven't been there. I think it's as simple as that.
And Stones.
Yeah.
So where are you fitting them all in? It's hard without a piece of paper in front of you. Maybe you have that. I've got Grealish on the left, Foden on the right, Mount in the 10, Kane with Bellingham and Rice holding, Trippier, Stones, White and Chilwell. But the fullbacks are very difficult to choose. And I've put Pickford in goal, but I thought Johnson played really well yesterday. I wouldn't mind.
But then you've got nobody running beyond Kane.
Oh, then I'm going out in the group stages, but I'm having a good time.
I'm sitting deep and watching you play pretty patterns in front of me, and I'm not worried by that.
I think Calvin Phillips will play over Bellingham if he played against Poland in the toughest game they've had this year. And I think they need him. I think they need, it's not very exciting, is it? But I think they need the double pivot in midfield. And I think Calvin Phillips, although he's a bit unglamorous, I think he's actually a really good player and very underrated and has a better passing range than people kind of realise. And I thought Bellingham gave Rice a lot of work to do against Austria, although he was good on the ball and looks very accomplished. And I think every chance he'll have a really good impact at this tournament. I don't think he's like a Walcott-style risk or anything like that. But you do wonder just about that at international level, where you can get picked off.
And I think the other thing, if you have Phillips there, is it does slightly liberate Rice. And I think he is good at, you know, making those occasional driving runs from deep. And that gives England an extra angle. But that, again, means you're leaving out one of the more glamorous, creative players.
Going from sort of plain rice to what my wife calls bejeweled rice, where she puts some onion and maybe a bit of chard through it. And it really does make it pop.
Was that Southgate said yesterday, you know, when he was asked about can you get them all into the side yesterday? And he just made the point that, well, look at the 1998 World Cup. Michael Owen didn't start the first game. David Beckham didn't start the first game. We've got a load of games here. We've got a bench to use. And there are different, there might be different teams that they'll use for different opponents, basically. So It's not all, Croatia is there, but then they've also got to play another one after that.
That's a good point. Jonathan, have you worked out your 11 now?
It really depends on what shape you're going to go for. I mean, if it's a 4-2-3-1 or a 4-3-3, then I definitely think that I think he will go with Sterling ultimately, because I think he is loyal to certain players. But for me, if you're going to have a runner in behind, then Sterling could be the one. Rashford maybe, but I would personally go with Grealish. That's just my feeling.
So you're leaving Foden out?
I'd probably leave Foden out, yeah. I mean, I'm not saying I would, but I think that's what Southgate will do. If it was against Croatia, I'd play Foden and Grealish either side of Kane. If it's a 4-2-3-1, as we said, with Mount, obviously. And then Rice and maybe Phillips or Belling.
Wilson?
I would at least start off 4-3-3, but I would have the back three ready in case things go wrong. I think on the evidence of yesterday, I'd play... In the back four, I'd play White alongside Stones. And obviously, they've never played together, so that's a concern. But hopefully, in training, you sort that out. Right back, I genuinely don't have a clue which of the three I'd go for. But I would probably go for Walker, just as the man who feels in possession and the fact he plays with Stones, at club level. So they hopefully have some kind of relationship. Left back, I think, is a toss-up. But personally, I'd probably go Chilwell. I'd then have Calvin Phillips, Rice, Mount, Kane with Foden to the left, and I would probably go Sancho to the right, just because he's the only one who naturally plays from the right, and I think you do need that combination of somebody who drops deep and a runner to go beyond.
Yogi says, isn't the heartwarming tale of the Romanian captain's rise from humble beginnings to international defender stardom a real Vlad Ciriccia's story? Thank you very much for that. It was a great foul on Calvert-Lewin for the penalty, and he's really changed his appearance. He's gone from sort of slightly debonair Spurs, soft centre-back to henchman in Steven Seagal movie look since I last saw him. Andrew says, can football really come home in that monstrosity of a second kit? I quite like that kit. I don't know where you stand on that kit, Jacob.
I didn't have a big problem.
You didn't have a big problem? I quite liked it.
But it's blue.
Yeah, it's blue.
Why do England wear blue? Okay. England's second should be red.
Blue passports.
Stylus says, Southgate looked like a 15-year-old trying on his dad's suit for the prom. Why is he dressing so poorly after his viral waistcoat in the World Cup? Richard,
he looks like Tony Soprano.
Do you think it? Yes, it is slightly. But you can't be Tony Soprano if you don't have the girth. Do you not think? It just doesn't work, does it? Richard Jolly, Ben Godfrey joins Walker, Pike, Jones, Wilson and Fraser amongst Dad's Army characters to win an England cap. Only Mannering to go, which is quite the detail. It's quite the issue, isn't it? There is a young... Jonathan, you don't know any non-league young sort of 16-year-olds, Kyle Mannering's playing that could eventually make it.
I'm afraid.
Anyway, let's talk about the booing of the taking the knee. It happened again. Thomas said, what can be done for those that continue to boo taking the knee? It upset me hearing it on the radio. And I'm a white privileged man. Goodness knows how the players take it. Is walking off the answer? I'm interested in that. And we obviously talked about it on the last pod. It's going to happen in every England game. I'm also interested in how sort of we should cover it on the pod. Jacob, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't surprised when it happened, even though Southgate on Saturday, I think, really gave the booers very little room for manoeuvre. I think that his argument was very difficult to argue with. And I think once you've heard what Southgate had to say, if you're still doing it, then, in my opinion, it's essentially a racist act to boo the knee, because you've been told the argument that it's somehow a political stand to take the knee, that somehow these footballers are part of the rise of Marxism in a country with a very big conservative majority is disingenuous at best. And I think it just comes down to another excuse, another reason just to be racist, and it's really depressing. I wonder how it's affecting the players when it happens. I wonder how it even affected someone like Tyrone Mings, who's very vocal on these issues and didn't look very focused at the start of the game. I might be jumping to conclusions there, but it is upsetting when it happens, and to be booed by your own fans, booed by your own England fans when that happens. I think that would probably make me emotional, but maybe that's why I'm not a top level professional athlete with, you know, superb mental strength. Maybe they're better at it than I would be. But the whole thing is extremely depressing, and I think that when it comes to it, if it's happening in the Croatia game and further on, especially if there are bigger crowds, as you know, restrictions lift, then it's just going to be extremely depressing. And I think at this stage you do wonder whether these people should be allowed in, and or what exactly can be done to tackle it. I think that I read that the people who were at these games, you know, those tickets went to the England Supporters Club, didn't it? So, you know, that's the core of the England support, essentially, who are doing that.
Yeah, I mean, I would echo what Jacob said. To be honest, it's quite depressing. There was one thing that Ian Wright said on the commentary, which I found sort of counterintuitive to what a lot of people were saying, where he said you've got to try and reach these people, which I thought was an interesting point, and one that I kind of do agree with. But ultimately, I struggle to see how you can reach these people. There's a wider kind of political debate, which is a bit more, you know, it's a football podcast, isn't it? So it's difficult to really go deep on it. But I look at it as kind of you can't really reach these people, is the way I see it. Like, they know what it means. I don't think there's any debate. The whole Marx thing is just, I think, nonsense. Even the idea, you know, kind of came out of Black Lives Matter, and there's been a lot of kind of talk about Black Lives Matter and trying to make it, trying to change the meaning of maybe the aims of it and that kind of thing. Even if you go along with that, as Jacob said, you know, Southgate kind of made it quite clear, and people still booed it. So I don't think you can really have that excuse. For me, it's disappointing. I mean, I thought Bukayo Saka, for example, when he gave his interview after such a memorable game for him, you know, when he scored his first England goal, when they asked him about it, he looked genuinely sad to me. He looked like, you know, he looked confused. People kind of described him as being confused, but he also looked to me quite sad. And I think there's a mental health issue there you have to kind of consider for the players. Like, for how long does this have to go on for them being booed? And I think it will continue to be booed. I just don't think it's going to stop. If you start this Premier League next season, for example, it will continue. So there is an element. The bottom line is there is an element of England that does not want the aims of that, of taking the knee to be realised. And so they're going to continue booing, and it's not going to stop. They're not going to be reached and kind of suddenly have a light bulb moment where they suddenly realise and say, okay, I'm going to support it. To be honest, you also have to kind of counter it with the fact that there were a lot of people who did clap, and I suppose, you know, we do tend to look towards the negative more than the positive at times, and it's encouraging that there were people who in the stadium were clapping. But ultimately, there is that section of people who in England, you know, we are in a country where we've had quite a divisive political background for the last 5 years. And ultimately, usually, it's directed in a certain way towards a certain people. You know, I look at the case of, for example, Dejan Reed, who was just stabbed to death in an incident in Birmingham. And you really do start to worry about how this is all playing out and really what's the aim of it. And is it actually having any benefit compared to maybe the polarization of what's happening? So I think it's a strong message for them to send out. And I think it's positive that the players feel empowered enough to say, we're going to do this no matter what. As Jacob says, I agree, you know, it's not going to help the players, is it? And I think this is going to be potentially a downfall for England in the tournament, if we look at it from a sporting point of view, because if you're being booed at the start of every game, it's not going to help the players, is it? So, and there are a number of black players in the team, and that's just the way it is. So, you know, from the sporting point of view, it's not going to help England whatsoever, and it's really sad. And then, you know, there's a wider, obviously, political point there to widen out, and a societal point where, you know, we are in a situation in England at this moment in time where society is becoming more and more polarized, sadly, and we have to kind of figure out if it's the right message to be continuing to take the knee. Not because I'm not saying that we should stop it, but simply for the fact that it's going to harden these opinions. There's more and more people coming out and kind of on Twitter and that kind of thing, more harden their opinion to continue booing it. And I just wonder where we're going with this, really.
Mm. Although you just can't, you know, what's interesting is, sort of people like me tweeting, you know, it's nothing to do with Marxism. You know, how many football matches have I been to or been in the pub and I've never heard the conversation? Do you know what really irks me about Marxism? It's just not a chat I've ever heard at a football match. And you overhear a lot of conversations. You know,
The thing for me is, I mean, I used to be a season ticket holder at a Premier League club before I started working in football, and I went to many, many games. If you were to ask me today, would I go to watch a game or where they're going to take the knee? If I'm being totally frank, I'd be more hesitant now, because just as a black person, because I don't want half the crowd to be booing around me while they're taking the knee. It's just awkward. And I'm not saying it would affect me. It probably would affect me. But, you know, the point I'm trying to make is, would I go to games now? I'd probably think twice. And that's sad. And the reason for that is because I don't want to be around people who are going to start booing and that kind of thing, or having to justify it. Or it's just kind of like, I do think people would, you know, non-white people would probably start to think twice about would they go to games if this was to continue, say, into the Premier League next season. So you have to kind of look at it from that point of view. And also, like I say, that, you know, the mental health of the players and that kind of thing, like this just keeps happening and happening and happening every week. And obviously there's racist incidents. We have to realise perhaps where we are as a society at this moment in time. And I suppose my question is, you know, there aren't any real tangible outcomes from this taking the knee, is there, at the moment? I don't really see what the tangible outcomes of this actually are at this moment in time. So although it's a nice gesture, I'm starting to question in my mind, like, what is the value of it, the actual tangible value that we're going to reach out with? If more and more people are going to become hard in their opinion and boo, then really, where are we going? That's the point I'm trying to make. And from my own, like I say, from my own anecdotal point of view, I would be more reluctant to go to a game now, because I feel that if there's people going to be booing around me, then, you know, is that going to add to my enjoyment of going to a football match, which ultimately is entertainment? I'm there to have fun. So that's just my perspective. I think a few people probably agree with me on that. But yeah, it's sad. And, you know, but ultimately that's where we are in England at this moment in time, I think. And that's just the fact that we have to face that, and we have to realise that that's where we are.
Just wonder, Wilson, before we end part one, how, if it keeps happening, you know, should we devote 10 minutes of the podcast every time it happens to it, or just acknowledge that it's happened and carry on?
I don't know. I mean, I think, yeah, I think in the end you just have to acknowledge it's happened and carry on. I mean, in terms of practical things of what can you do to stop it, I'm not sure legally there is a huge amount you can do, because while I agree that in the context of what Southgate has said, to boo it is a racist act, I'm not sure that's would stand up to any kind of legal definition. So I think probably the only thing you can do is, when you join the England Supporters Club, or when you buy your season ticket for a club, one of the things you would sign up to is not to engage in behaviour that could be deemed racist, including booing of the taking of a knee. And then at least there's a direct, you've signed a contract not to do that. So if you do it, you can be kicked out. But it's a very tricky thing for the authorities to deal with. On the point that Jonathan was making, the clear does pretty quickly, and especially when grounds fill up, become the danger of confrontation. If you've got somebody in one seat applauding the taking of a knee and the person in the next seat's booing it. And that's not a healthy thing. It's not a healthy environment for a game to be played, and that then becomes a public order issue.
Yeah, could I just add one thing as well, if I may? And you make great points. I just think that this idea of kind of like, should we kick those people out of the stadiums and that kind of thing? I think you can do that. And I think there is an argument, of course, you can say it's a racist act and things like that. But ultimately, is it healthy to drive them, these people away? Like, they're going to have these views continually. And I just feel like there is a growing feeling in England that there's more and more people who feel this way. So that's why I sort of mentioned the Ian Wright point, where he said that you still have to try and reach these people. And I do agree with that. I don't know in what format, whether it's in the stadium or whether it's by kicking them out. But I'm not sure it's healthy to just sort of say, if you boo, you're thrown out of the stadium. I do think people have a right to maybe to boo it. I'm not trying to say that, like, not everybody's going to have the same opinion on everything. And so it would be foolish for me to say, oh, you have no right to boo it. And I know that sounds strange in a way, but I'm not sure the value of just throwing everybody out who boos, if that makes sense. Because at the end of the day, they have their own opinion as well. And as long as it's not kind of harassing people, then you have to, that's what I mean. It's really, really hard to answer this in a football context, because ultimately they're going to continue having these views. And the thing that you worry about is kind of who are these people? Like, are they people then working in positions of power when it comes to employment, things like that? You know what I mean? These are people who are in everyday society, usually, mostly anyway. So it's a really complex debate in terms of how to, but I don't think like just driving everyone out who boos or that kind of thing is going to help. And just finally on your question, Max, you know, Gareth Southgate said that they're going to try not to address it for the rest of the tournament, and kind of he said that to his players that he's going to ask for the media maybe to not ask them so many questions about it. And I think that's maybe a positive thing. And I know Rashford was asked about it after the game yesterday, for example. I don't think it's healthy if every single game they're asked about it continually. Now, I think Gareth tried to make the point that that's our stance for the tournament. We're going to continue with it, and that's the way it's going to be. And I'm not sure if questioning it all the time and that kind of thing is valuable, because and talking about it, because it's just adding more weight to the people who are booing and giving them more airtime, if that makes sense. So, but yes, it's really, really complex, and it's a tough one, isn't it?
All right, that'll do for part one. We'll be back in a second. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. We have a live show, Jonathan Wilson, on Thursday night, 7:30 p.m. Me, you, Lars and Barry. You can get your tickets from theguardian.com/guardianlive. Are you excited about it?
Never been more excited in my life.
I feel that between you, Lars and Barry, no one's really giving it the big sell. And I feel that we have to start actually giving enthusiastic answers to this question when I deliver it for us to sell the 6 billion tickets we're looking to sell.
That was enthusiastic. I've said I've literally never been more excited. I mean, it was a lie, but it'll be great. You know what you're getting. You're getting us.
Yeah.
Why wouldn't you want to pay for that?
I totally agree. When you can get it every day. No.
Well, but they can ask their own questions. They can see us. Exciting breaking news.
Yeah.
This is probably going to be your last chance to see me in this flat.
Well, now that is big, isn't it? That's huge,
massive,
isn't it?
The bookcases could be in a completely different orientation next time, if there is another time. And there won't be if you don't buy tickets.
Exactly. Theguardian.com/guardianlive. We're looking forward to seeing you. If you can't watch it live, you can, you watch it the next day or the next day or the next day. That's totally fine. Scotland won 1-0 in Luxembourg. Interesting to see Che Adams and Lyndon Dykes up front together. They combined for the goal, I suppose, 65 minutes against 10 men. A 1-0 victory against Luxembourg is not amazingly impressive. But Wilson, they look like a cogent team, don't they?
Yeah, I thought they played well. Anyway, I think we should remember this is a decent Luxembourg. I mean, yeah, without overselling that, this is not the Luxembourg of 10 or 15 years ago. This is a Luxembourg who recently won away in Ireland. They've developed a lot.
That's not saying much, though, is it? Let's face it.
But I think they're a decent mid-ranking European nation. I think are they a better side than Romania? Maybe not, but I don't think they're that far off, because I think they are, maybe player for player, they're not as good as Romania, but I think they are a good unit. And I think Scotland actually played really well. And okay, it's hard to judge against 10 men. I thought they could have won that much more easily. But okay, Scotland had the two goals ruled out. But I mean, Dykes could easily have had two or three goals. They linked really well in the move that led to the red card. There could have been a second red card. Probably should have been a second red card for that horrendous foul on Billy Gilmore. So, it was 1-0 going on sort of 3 or 4-0. But I guess the question now is, I'd sort of assume Scotland would play one up front. But when that Dykes-Adams partnership looks so promising, maybe they do go with two up front.
Mm. And Billy Gilmore, you've seen a fair amount of Gilmore, as much as anyone, Jacob, given that he hasn't had that much time playing for Chelsea. But he's such a special player, isn't it? The foul was terrible. Olivier Till, who came off the bench and just ran into him, probably should have been a red card. But if Gilmore gets on the pitch and plays, I'm just getting nervous for the England game, basically, Jacob.
Right. He's a really good player. He's unlucky. I think if Lampard had stayed, I think that Gilmore would have played much more in the second half of the season. I'm not saying that in itself should have happened. But Tuchel obviously had a certain way that he wanted to play, and then it's very difficult for Gilmore to get in when you've got players like Jorginho, Kovacic and Kante in front of you, and the stakes are so high. He struggled a little bit at times when he did come in and out of the team, handful of appearances for Chelsea. The last one, I think, was against Arsenal with the 1-0 defeat at Stamford Bridge, and he got taken off at half-time, which was maybe less a reflection of himself rather than they just wanted to get a bit more attacking in the second half. So, he's had a difficult season after that injury that he picked up last summer and hasn't played too much. But, he's such a talented player. I don't think it's going to take him that long to get into his stride. May need a loan next season. But I think for this summer, he's hugely encouraging for him to be in there. It's a huge vote of confidence as well for him to be in there, given that he's not played that much. It shows how highly he is rated within football. And yeah, I think he will, if he plays against England, then he'll definitely be a worry for them because, you know, he the way that he passes, controls, you know, he's small, but he gets stuck in. You know, he's not remotely worried about getting hurt at all. He can win the ball. He's very skillful. And, you know, those people will go back to those two performances that he gave when he first came into the side against Liverpool and Everton last season, just before lockdown. And, you know, that showed how good he is. I wouldn't be at all surprised to see, you know, they do have some good options in midfield, but I think that Gilmore is probably, you know, a level potentially above quite a few of them already.
Wales drew 0-0 with Albania. They looked slightly better when Kiefer Moore came on up front and held it up. There's sort of debate about whether they go with Bale in that false nine with Daniel James and Harry Wilson either side, or play Kiefer Moore with Bale and James, and Wilson probably drops out. We're in heavy negotiations with Ellis James to come on soon and give us a big Welsh preview.
Well, I think the Kiefer Moore issue, I think, is I agree with you. I think they look better when he's there, but the problem for them in their group is they've got Italy and Turkey, who probably have the two most sort of classical old school centre back pairings. So, I mean, in Italy's case, not just old school, but just old.
Chiellini and Bonucci, Chiellini, isn't it, still?
Bonucci. And Turkey have got Soyuncu and Demirel, who are, you know, two big, towering, good in the air. So, I don't know. I just think that makes that decision a bit more complicated, that, you know, Kiefer Moore's asset directly plays into the asset of two of your direct opponents in the group.
Elsewhere, Belgium beat Croatia 1-0. Romelu Lukaku, Richard Jolystat, the youngest European to get 60 international goals since Gert Muller. Netherlands beat Georgia pretty easily. De Ligt didn't play in that game. Denmark beat Bosnia-Herzegovina. Spain's squad is in isolation after Sergio Busquets tested positive for COVID. Although the other members of the 24-man squad tested negative, COVID protocols have been applied in accordance with UEFA and the Spanish Health Ministry guidelines, which means all players and staff had to isolate within Spain's La Rodas HQ. Individual sessions replacing normal training. COVID may well have a big effect in this tournament, but, you know, individual training for everybody for all that time just before the tournament is not helpful. Anyway, their under-21s will play in a friendly against Lithuania. Jonathan, given that you watch every sort of under-20s football match in the whole of the world, and across Europe, can you give us some ones to watch to impress our friends when we're discussing the Euros?
Yeah, sure. There's not too many actually in this tournament. I wonder if, you know, the change of the year and that kind of thing, maybe people have gone for a bit more experience and that kind of thing. There's a few players maybe to look out for who are under 23. Would that help, or does it have to be under 21?
I just want someone I haven't heard of, you know.
All right, we're going to
say Frankie De Jong because I know him.
No, I think the main one I would probably look towards is Alexander Isak. He's 21 years old, playing for Sweden. He was the sixth top scorer in La Liga. I think he got 17 goals. Sort of a tall, pacey kind of striker. Obviously, Zlatan, I think he got injured now, so he's not going to be taking part. So Isak will probably come into the team and give Sweden a good chance of qualifying. He's a really, really good player. Jeremy Doku at Belgium is a 19-year-old who I think is a winger. He moved to Stade Rennes in France from Belgium, and he's a really, really exciting player. I'm not sure how much game time he'll get, but he's an interesting one. The thing is, a lot of the young players, I mean, you've got, for example, I think one of the players to really look out for is Federico Chiesa, but he's 23, so it's not exactly like he's an unknown. He's been at Juventus, 33 games, 9 goals, 9 assists, but I think this could be his breakout tournament in terms of maybe people who don't know him. I think he could be a really, really good player. He's really exciting, and I think he's probably ready to go to that next level. He's a big game player as well, so I think he'll enjoy that challenge of the Euros. Maybe a bit more unknown players. Eljif Elmas, who's playing for North Macedonia. He's 21 years old. He's at Napoli. He's got 27 games, 7 goals for the national team. And he's a sort of a young player who there's a lot of talk about, and he's an exciting player and maybe one for a bit of a more hipster team. If you're going to be watching North Macedonia. And I think one player who could potentially be a breakout, I think the Netherlands have got two. So Owen Wijndal, hopefully I'm saying that correctly, is a 21-year-old left-back who will probably go on. If not now, then soon. He's a very exciting left-back who's done really well. And I think the one that a lot of people maybe may know about, but just for those who don't, Ryan Gravenberch. He's a 19-year-old at Ajax. People have perhaps lazily dubbed in the next Paul Pogba, but he is kind of similar in some ways in terms of style of play, and he's a very exciting midfielder. He played, I think, last night. I think obviously De Jong and Wijnaldum will be the main two in that Dutch midfield, but I think Gravenberch has the chance of potentially getting into the team. So he's a really, really exciting prospect, and I think there'll be a lot of interest in him, you know, if not after this tournament, then certainly in the next year or so.
That's exactly what I wanted. Slightly nervous when you start talking about Zlatan as a young one to watch. No, that was great.
Keep an eye on him.
Right, that'll do for part two. We'll round off any other business in part three. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Well done to all the players who've got the PFA awards. Kevin De Bruyne, Men's Player of the Year for a second season. Phil Foden, Young Player of the Year. Chelsea's Fran Kirby got the Women's Player of the Year. Manchester City's Lauren Hemp got the Women's Young Player of the Year for the third time. De Bruyne, the first player to win the Men's Award for two straight campaigns since Cristiano Ronaldo in 06-07 and 07-08. You may not have seen the CONCACAF Nations League final between the USA and Mexico. Amanda said, if you missed it, you missed a lively display of shithousery. Ethan Horvath, the hero, coming on in goal for the US. Zach Steffen injured his knee, I think. Saved a penalty in injury time in extra time after a terrible VAR decision. The ref, a Panamanian called John Pitti, had also given the USA a penalty by VAR, which Pulisic scored about 5 minutes to go. And he did, when he gives the penalty from the halfway line, he did it with such a defiant point. He sort of like leant right back and then sort of threw his arm forward as if he was like throwing a javelin. It was very exciting. Anyway, there was all sorts in that game. It's worth checking out the highlights. Simon says, what the hell's going on at Spurs? I'm genuinely concerned that you, Max, and Barry will be in charge next season. Jacob, what do you make of... Every day, it's just a new manager that seems to be in talks with Daniel Levy.
Yeah, I'm not surprised that the Conte thing fizzled out. I thought that Conte was too good for Spurs in their current state. And I thought as well, is he necessarily the manager that they need? As you know, which sounds odd, but you know, as good as he is. But do Tottenham, as they are, with the squad rebuilding that needs to be done, crying out for a... I want to win now manager, and give me lots of money, and a manager who has proven that he will work in pretty short cycles and will probably fall out with whoever, you know, is at the top. And I don't think that Antonio Conte would have taken that long to fall out with Daniel Levy. You know, Pochettino lasted much longer, but he was much more comfortable working on a slow build project, building towards something. And, you know, it took him a while to lose his patience. And it also kind of went against what Daniel Levy had said that they wanted to do when he wrote that letter to the fans at the end of the season, you know, a manager who's going to, you know, play expansive attacking football and sort of focus on youth and everything. And there's no real indication that Conte would have done that. But they're in a slight hole at the moment because there isn't an obvious candidate kind of screaming out that, you know, they've gone from Brendan Rodgers to Nagelsmann, and neither of those have seemed that they... Well, obviously Nagelsmann's gone to Bayern, and Brendan Rodgers doesn't seem like he wants to leave Leicester. You know, Hansi Flick was there, but has gone to... He's going to be managing Germany. Graham Potter has someone who's... He's done well at Brighton, but is he ready for that jump up to a club like Tottenham where there will be expectations? From what I can tell, it doesn't seem like the fans would be totally opposed to him because of the football that he plays and the fact that he does bring through young players. But at the same time, Brighton, it's not like they've had, you know, really high finishes under him. I still wouldn't be surprised should they go back for Ten Hag, and whether that one-year extension on the contract may well end up not being all it, you know, appeared at first glance.
Larry says, who wins the National League playoffs and why is it Torquay? Over the weekend, Jonathan, Notts County beat Chesterfield 3-2 with a last-minute winner. And Hartlepool beat Bromley 3-2, or slightly more comfortably. So we've got Torquay v Notts County and Stockport v Hartlepool. Pick us a winner.
It's tough to call a winner, actually. I mean, I think it's arguably the best playoffs in the country, the National League playoffs. It's one game. There's no second legs. It's win or bust. And obviously, if you the lower down the table you are, you have to go away from home. That decides whether you're at home or away. Notts County came back from behind and were kind of lucky. The goalkeeper got injured and had to play like 30 minutes because they had no keeper on the bench. And he couldn't walk, basically. And eventually they came from 2-1 down and scored a sort of a 90th minute winner, bullet header, kind of typical sort of thumping centre-back header in the last minute. And that, you know, it was really, really, that was a really good game, to be honest. Brilliant game against Chesterfield. I think Notts County have a decent shout. Torquay haven't been in amazing form in the last sort of couple of months, and Notts County have got good momentum about them, but they've got to go away, obviously, and so Torquay will have home advantage because they finish higher in the table. I think Stockport are probably the favourites at this moment in time. They've got Hartlepool at home. Hartlepool battered Bromley in the first half, first half 3-0, and then it finished 3-2. But I think Stockport all round look quite strong. So I think it'd be Stockport or Notts County if I had to call it.
Jimmy says, Lilybet, are Harry and Meghan about to launch a new online sports betting company? Enjoy that. Obviously, we'll take no adverts when they do. Here's an email from the 4th of February 2020 that didn't come through to us because we didn't have the login at that time. Dear Pod, first of all, this email comes to you from your number one Belgian fan. The Pod has truly seen the world as I've listened to it while living in Belgium, Scotland, New Zealand, and now Belgium again. This is a compliment for me, so I apologise, but you can disregard it, Wilson, if you like. May I please commend the soothing, healing voice of Max? Last Thursday, this is the 30th of January 2020, at around the half-hour mark, Max read out Liverpool's fixtures and where they might drop points still. This sound was extremely pleasant to listen to, so much so that I've listened to it several times a day since then. Blimey. If you have heard of ASMR, have you heard of ASMR, everyone? This is...
I was told my pepper eating was an effective form of ASMR.
Right, okay. So ASMR, is this commonly knowledge? Everyone sort of knows what it is. Autonomous sensory meridian response. Sometimes autosensory meridian response, a tingling sensation that typically begins on the scalp and moves down the back of the neck and the upper spine. I get it for the Welsh national anthem, actually. A pleasant form of paresthesia. Is that right? Paresthesia. This moment was definitely part of it. Lastly, a shout out to Belgium in general and Royal Antwerp FC in particular. Regards, Toon. Thank you, Toon. And
my great-great-grandfather emigrated to Sunderland from Antwerp.
Oh, thanks for bringing it back to you, Jonathan.
No, it's a pleasure. I was just...
And finally on...
For you, of all people to say that, unbelievable.
And finally, this from Daniel B. Hello, Pod. Long-time listener from Australia. First time writing in. I love it to bits. This is on the subject of car accidents while listening to the pod. Not quite a car accident, and recency bias of the topic might work against me, though I thought I should share. 3 years ago during the World Cup in Russia, a friend of mine, Max, and I bought the cheapest second-hand car we could find in Lithuania and drove it up across the border for the tournament. Needless to say, it shat itself a week in, and we ended up having to get a really dodgy tow from Kazan to Samara, about 6 hours on a pocketed road alongside the winding Volga River to watch Australia's second game with Denmark. The tow truck cabin only had space for one, so we opted to sit in our broken steed as it got towed along. So in the long, golden Slavic summer light, with our feet on the dash, 40-cent beers in our hand from the local corner store, and no engine noise to compete with it, we caught up on the latest episodes of the pod and bonded irrevocably with Barry's sage and dulcet tones as he noted Australia were unlucky not to get a point from our opening game with eventual champions France, which in hindsight means more or less we were robbed of our maiden trophy.
I don't want to be pedantic. Yeah, I do want to be pedantic. But it's in Tatarstan, so it's not Slavic. Me and Nick Ames did that journey many times.
Did you do it being towed with your feet on the dash, drinking 40-cent beer?
No, Nick managed to find a minibus somehow. I don't quite know how. And the first and last bit of the road is fine, but the middle bit really is pretty decrepit. So it was loads of journalists in that bus. I mean, that bus had gone down. The cream of British journalism gone. Lucky, really.
Yeah. Anyway, Dan, thank you for that message. And it's for his friend Joseph, who's had a hard year. Go Spurs. Look, that'll do for today's podcast. Jacob, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jonathan.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Wilson.
Cheers, thank you.
We'll be back tomorrow.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.